Playback on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by FexcoCurrency.com. Your route to great rate travel money at participating credit unions.
Good morning.
As an intellectual vibration, smack dab in the middle of spectrum, green can be a problem. That's because there's so many different greens inside of green, and each one has a different IQ. There's the green that should never have happened, the stupid green. The green that is green with envy. Then there's the so-so green. The who cares anyway green. But somewhere in green is a green here and there that has something to say. A truly intelligent green. A green with some integrity. That's the kind of green for you and me. There's a green to be seen with. Vivid, vibrant, living alive. We should spend the better part of our time, yours and mine, with a green like this. Maybe some of it would rub off.
Oh, and for the weekend that's in it, there really is no other colour. And the twang of Ken Nordine, highly appropriate given this week's big news. We doff the cap to Gavin Jennings for what might just be the line of the week.
Talk to Joe. Biden bound for Ireland will trace the US president's Irish roots.
Very good. And the Biden visit is indeed on the cards for April. But just listen to all the ducks that are getting in a row ahead of that visit. With Clare, Pat Leahy, former assistant Garda commissioner.
There'll be a series of senior management meetings now, and they'll be discussing proposed locations, site visits. They'll be discussing the routes. They'll be discussing possible modes of transport, the duration of the engagements, the exposure to risk, and then what mitigation strategies and prevention strategies are available to them. They'll be cancelling annual leave and rest days for members in the adjoining divisions at least, but that could extend to Dublin, and it certainly will for specialist services. Mm-hmm. They'll be engaging, if not already, with the Taoiseach's Department, the Department of Justice, the Department of Defence, the US State Department, the Secret Service, the UK government, and also the PSNI. So there's huge engagement going on even right now, I would suggest. So they'll be engaging in strategic planning, followed then by very detailed operational planning right up to the day of the arrival and throughout the visit itself.
A lot of logistics. But will he make it to the county that matters? We speak, of course, of Mayo, what with the Bluets of Ballina, and we will begrudgingly concede the Finnegans of Louth if we must. But really, it is all about Cundawayo. Here is local historian and genealogist Aileen Horkin on the News at One.
Joe Biden's ancestor, Edward Bluett, lived and worked in the town of Ballina. He was born in 1795 and he married a lady called Mary Mulderig. And for people interested in local genealogy, around here the surname Mulderig sometimes translates to Reddington. So they were living on Garden Street in Ballina, and he worked as an overseer, among other jobs, with the Ordnance Survey and Griffiths Valuation. And then he started to do relief works during the famine, which provided huge relief to the area because Ballina, as a lot of people will know, was very badly hit by the famine.
Where did they go after that? How soon did they move
In 1850, they left the Ballina area and moved to Scranton in the States. And funnily enough, there's a huge amount of chain migration from the Ballina area to Scranton. So many people in the town have relatives there today.
And tell us about the other side.
The other side, the Finnegans, we don't know too much about the Finnegans over here in County Mayo. We'd be very focused in on the Bluets. I know they have close relations in Cooley as well, and they are descendants of Ambrose J. Finnegan, who married Geraldine Bluett, who was Joe Biden's grandmother.
Did I hear mention of Galway roots as well?
Didn't hear any mention of those, Gavin. It's all about Mayo today.
Hopping on the bandwagon, Mayo or nothing, my friend. And staying with the green, Let the Moss Grow, Anya Murray Dares You. Her book is Wild Embrace, connecting to the wonder of Ireland's natural world. She spoke to Oliver.
You're a fan of moss.
I am a big fan of moss. Yes, yeah. There was a lot of moss in my college dissertation. And I have been fascinated with them since. But even just, look, if you look through a hand lens or a magnifying glass at mosses, the geometrical patterns are really incredible. They're very beautiful. And these are things we walk past every day without thinking about.
A lot of people now are going, no, I have my lawn is gone with the moss. There's just nothing but moss there. And they're shaking your fist at the moss woman on the radio.
Yeah, there is a perception that we like our very manicured, perfect green lawns. And really, when we open up to mow the lawns less, so things like no mow May, whereas we don't mow the lawn during May and we allow a few more wildflowers in, that creates so much more colour and texture and vibrant life.
It looks better, isn't it? I mean, it's a good solution to, you know, if people are sick of looking at the moss, because they cut the moss with the lawnmower and then it just turns white. Or if they try to kill it, it just turns black.
Yes.
Like end times.
Yes. At the beginning of COVID, I have an elderly uncle who was always very pristine and correct in how he managed the garden. And I was encouraging him to mow a little bit less. And he was really worried genuinely about what the neighbours might think. But he did this. And then he was ringing me up, effusing about all the different bumblebees and the different butterflies that were in the garden. And like he was converted himself by observing the changes.
Yeah. Purely because of what he had done.
Yeah.
Go on, scandalise those neighbours. And is it a weed or is it a flower? Or is it just pretty?
It's a lot about perception. Even things like dandelions are one of the most important wildflowers for, like right now, we've got early emerging bumblebees and tortoiseshell butterflies are coming out of their winter hibernation.
We see them already.
Soon, yeah, and probably in the next week or so. And they need, like, they've been asleep all winter and they need a good fill of sugary nectar. And what's out there now but dandelions? So you'll see them on the dandelions. And yet we have this instinct to get rid of the dandelions.
Yeah.
We don't like them, but they're really important for pollinators.
I'm one of the people who kind of, when you see the what do you call the wind catching seeds when they're on the dandelion later?
That's
in the,
right.
I kind of grab them, going, no, they're spreading everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a native Irish wildflower, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And there's so many other native, like what we would think of as weeds. And if we switch our perception a little bit, we can see that many of these things have huge value, not just for pollinators, but for us as well. Like, if you know, I love my front garden. It's a complete mess. It's a tangle of whatever kind of makes its way in there. And I love that. It is about perception.
That's a great defence if someone says, well, what is the state of your garden? I'm ecologically minded.
Oliver, feet up, actively rewilding. And on drive time, if you're Irish, you should sound Irish. Unless, of course, you're on radio or television, in which case you should talk properly or be received pronunciation. Just think the BBC, darling.
When you say RP, received pronunciation, it's or an imitation, really, of the standard British accent, I think, traditionally associated with BBC newsreaders and presenters. One of the main things here is the difference between Irish English and British English, and it's all to do with the R sound or the OR sound.
Exactly.
Which
so
one is right?
Well, I suppose the second one that you did there was very much related to what we call now advanced Dublin English, which is a newer form of pronunciation. It's, I suppose, a follow-on from the much maligned D4 or Dart speak. But going back to the RP, it's what we call, I suppose, an R-less pronunciation. So, for example, yard would be pronounced as yard, but it would be quite unusual for an Irish person to speak with that particular feature.
But what is happening?
The ads, it was that one feature.
Linguist Dr. Joan O'Sullivan from Limerick's Mary Eye College. And speaking of missing ors, have a listen to this.
Irish sugar, a taste of the goodness we're rich in.
Oh, Irish sugar, eh?
So you can hear, yeah, sugar. There's no R. Okay, so you can hear what you mean there. So is it like, what was going on with that? Was that some sort of inferiority complex that we sort of felt we had to ape British pronunciation in order to be proper and right?
Yeah, and it actually was going on in New Zealand as well. There was a study done in the 1980s in New Zealand where they were kind of leaning towards an RP accent as well. So I think it's this whole kind of colonial hangover, if you like. It wasn't that we were speaking in our normal everyday conversation with an RP accent, but we seemed to think that for this media context, for the big broadcaster, that we had to be like the BBC. Yeah.
Only on the big broadcaster, mind you. But these days, we are more likely to drop our T's.
It's a soft Irish T, for example, which was criticised very often by another late great broadcaster, Gay Byrne.
Absolutely. And that still seems to be a sort of a common feature of Irish speech. Now, it's given way a bit to the what's called a flap, which is like the pronunciation of butter as butter, so that sort of American.
Oh, I hate it. I hate it, I must say. And I do it sometimes, but I've heard butter and better. I probably say it myself at times. What's happening there, Joan?
Yeah, I think that's definitely an influence of the media. You could even hear it in the ad that was on just prior to this piece. It was .ie. So I think we definitely have to.
You know, I can see why we might be trying to change. I remember actually working in the US and my boss in the shop I was working in was called Peter. And I remember saying to one of the girls that day, "Where is Peter?" And she said, "Peter? What's a Peter?" And I said, "Peter, is Peter around? What's a Peter?" And she literally couldn't make the leap to understand I was asking, "Where is Peter?"
You should have said Pather.
Meanwhile, over on Bowman on Sunday, this story from Leo Maguire, long-time compere of the Walden programme, and getting into RTE to do the show, "Do You Know Who I Am?" Or maybe you might know the voice.
And I had my identification thing, you see. And there was a new security man on the checkpoint, and obviously an ex-policeman. And I put up, I asked him where I was going, but I said, "Look, I'm very sorry, I left my jacket at home and everything in it, including my identification card." And I said, I'm Leo Maguire, I'm the compere of the Walton programme." Well, he said, "No, I'll tell you one thing, nobody could fake that voice of yours, go on in."
Oh, those were the days. But when it came to how he liked his music, well, we will let John Bowman do the introducing.
Leo Maguire was quite a purist and a conservative when it came to presenting Irish traditional music.
The point is, I don't go along with what I'm hearing as a modern presentation of traditional music. They distort rhythms. They've tried to combine Irish traditional melody with country and western, and I object violently to something that was composed by a blind fiddler or harper, somebody possibly sheltering under a hedge, to that being taken and distorted. If they want to distort something, let them write a tune of their own first and then distort that, but don't take a song, say the Coolin, for instance, and pull it around and throw in a 4-4 bar in the middle of a 3-4 movement, as they do. They just prolong notes and destroy what they don't understand. I'm all for tradition, completely frozen like a mammoth in the ice. It's come down to us, and I wanted to stay that way.
From Bowman on Sunday. But I think it's fair to say, we could he on Misha Freshen didn't get the memo.
Four country highways to my heart.
Are you sure this is the right song? Ho-ho!
Four country roads leading to a town in the county Galway, Galway, Galway. Four dusty roads, oh, take me to the town I love so well. Once in a while, I can hear that Kaylee music in the midnight hour, and I can see you there, your lovely eyes and long and golden hair.
Love lies, earth is a
Back in a bit. Welcome back. With Brendan, some epic breath holding.
So the most common question I get asked about freediving is, how long can you hold your breath?
Yeah, exactly.
And the answer to that is 5 minutes and 59 seconds. So you can see that 1 second makes a difference. I haven't made it to six just yet. And sticking with the theme of 59, I dive to 59 metres below the surface of the water.
That is Claire Walsh. She is a free diver. Essentially, and down you go. Her book is called Underwater, How Holding My Breath Taught Me to Live. And she talked to Brendan about a particularly difficult time in her life.
I was single and had been for a couple of years. I know you've just been talking about the housing crisis, but I was back living with mum and dad. My work had me geographically all over the place, picking up bits of work here and there to keep me going. And emotionally, probably similar. I was just as scattered. My friends, in comparison, were buying their first house, meeting their partners, getting engaged, having children and so on. And I felt like I couldn't just tick one of those boxes. And I think when you set yourself up, and this is like, I suppose, a through line throughout the book, is when you list things out like that and set them out as your goal, when you don't meet them, you feel like quite a failure in comparison to how your contemporaries are living. And this book was an effort to switch direction. Okay, I have no control over whether I meet someone or not. And I tried. I do describe some dates and navigating online dating. So this book, you know, was an effort to, you know, switch direction and think, okay, I keep chasing all these things, and the more I chase them, the further away I feel. And that gap can be a really, really lonely and quite a desolate place.
And like, for you, it did tip into actual mental health.
Yeah, and let's name it. It wasn't mental health, it was mental illness. And chicken or egg, you know, I think mental illness, what came first? I experienced it to a really heightened state in my late 20s, as I say in the book, the bad, blurry years. I don't really remember lots of detail around that.
She decided to go travelling and in the process fell in love with freediving. In fact, in 2019, she became the first person to represent Ireland at the Freediving World Championships. But when she spoke to Brendan, she talked about the profound silence she experiences when she dives.
So for me, the first thing I notice about a dive is that minute that I leave the surface, and I describe it. And usually when I describe a dive, I'm picturing the blue hole in Egypt. So I take the snorkel out of my mouth, having taken my big breath, and suddenly there is like almost like a blanket of sound in my ears. You don't hear anything. You're pulling yourself down. And for me, I connect to a rhythm of pull, glide, pull, glide.
And you're pulling by a rope.
This discipline, which is called free immersion, you're pulling down by rope. So you're trying to overcome buoyancy. You're trying to find that sweet spot that starts to allow you to free fall. So enter into what's called negative buoyancy, which is a term that pops up quite a lot in the book. And free fall, for me, I think it's the closest thing that I'll get to experience in flying.
Yeah.
And I describe it as kind of Peter Pan sort of flying, second star to the right sort of flying. It is magical. If you talk to any freediver and you say, how did your dive go? They will say, oh, the free fall. And then they'll get this dreamy look come over their face. It is nothing short of magical.
Put like that, it does sound rather amazing. Brendan, however, busting along here.
You don't want to race towards the surface.
Okay, I'm dying to get back up now. Like, that's the thing. I need to take a breath.
Oh, Brendan, you have to savour it.
So you're actually still calm at this stage. You're not going, I need to take a breath.
I am loving every second of it. And the first chapter, or the prologue, I describe a dive in full. The feel of the cold water over the parts of your body that aren't covered by your wetsuit. So your hands, your feet, parts of your face. So when you do turn, you know, it's a little bit more of a concentrated effort, but you're not going to race. So you want to take it all in,
but be focused. And I think that is, I suppose, the crux of a dive, finding that balance. So coming up, what I do is I want to make sure there is no space for negativity in my head. I don't want any little intruding thoughts creeping in and saying, oh God, there's a long way to go. Have you enough breath left? Have you enough? You know, they're not helpful. Mm-hmm. So instead, I usually just say little really silly or cheesy mantras like, I got this. I got this. You can do it. I'm thinking of what I'm going to do when I get to the surface. And what I'll do is I will breathe. I will remove my mask and I will signal and say, I'm okay. So usually you're coming up just repeating, I'm okay. I'm okay. I'm okay. And that is the way back up. And it is, again, magical.
Wow, that sounds quite profound. And it is also a feat of both body and mind.
It reminds me of a resilience I have. You know, holding your breath for that amount of time isn't easy. And I thought, because I've experienced mental illness, you know, that I was perhaps weak or negative. And these are words that I think get attached to people with depression, rightly or wrongly, or, you know, there are perceptions of it. And I know for me, that's what I thought about myself. That's what I feared. That's what I was so afraid, terrified, that that's what people thought of me. I was weak and I was negative, that I couldn't just snap out of it, despite my very privileged, lovely looking life. I felt this way. And then suddenly, when I found freediving, I felt strong.
So you found your thing.
I found my thing.
Claire Walsh with Brendan. And now to a man who might need to take a breath lest he fall over from all the excitement. I'm pretty sure that's happiness. Commentator Andrés Cantor being scraped off the floor after Lionel Messi's goal for Argentina in the last World Cup. And our Andrés, Damien O'Mara, joined Claire to dissect the many highs of sports commentary.
Have you ever tried that, though, the South American style goal celebration? You know, if you're doing the hurling or the football.
No, I won't lie to you. There's not a Ventolin inhaler on the market that would enable me to be able to do something like that. It's just so unique and so South American. And it's one of these ones, I think probably every kid growing up, if you had a remote interest in football, you tried it at some stage, didn't you?
Yes, you did. But you can't get away with it here, really. That's what you're saying, isn't it?
And like, so you mentioned there Andrés Cantor. The best thing about this is the clip of him also went viral because they had a camera, the GoPro in front of him. So the commentary itself is brilliant. But the emotion of a guy who grew up in Argentina, went to live in the States, came back to Argentina, and having waited so long to see them win the World Cup. But he's like the custodian of the elongated goal. I'm not going to try and do it at any stage over this item.
Wouldn't ask it.
Thanks
wouldn't
very
do it
much.
To you.
Well, we'll do. Well, we could give it a shot together towards the end. But it's just so unique.
Give us a bit of history, Damien.
The elongated goal can be traced back to the 40s. So there was a Brazilian commentator, Rebelo Jr., on radio back in the 40s who brought this in. And obviously the fact back then is that sports commentary was such a new discipline on radio. The story goes that he would do a short goal if it was a good chance. And if it was a better chance, it would be a slightly longer goal. Mm-hmm. And then when the goal was eventually scored, he would go on. But you have to imagine how much practice must go into this.
Lots of time in front of the mirror, can you imagine?
Having the lung capacity ready to go.
And although it's slightly unedifying to blow one's own trumpet, blow it we must.
I was kind of conscious, going back through the archives, I didn't want to come in and just have loads of clips of Irish commentators. And then you start to step away from it and you go, well, actually, there are areas around the world where we've had significant influence. And like Micheál O'Hare, you know, Grand National commentary, for example, you cannot do an item like this or cannot talk about the Grand National without including Micheál O'Hare.
And this is what we're going to hear now, one of the classic horse racing moments. And this is the voice of Micheál O'Hare.
With Rutherford's along the inside, and he's been, and Rutherford has been hampered, and so has Castle Falls, Rochetto has fallen, Principal has fallen, Norther has fallen, Curtain Lad has fallen, the Fossa has fallen, there's a right pile up, Leedsy has climbed over the fence and left his jockey there, and now with all this mayhem, Fornavon has gone off and he's off. He's about 50, 100 yards in front of everything else.
Now, what we learned from that is that man did his homework.
Oh, this is phenomenal. So this, and again, when The Guardian and the BBC and other outlets compiled the greatest ever sports commentaries, this always features very prominently. So Foinaven was 100-1 shot, wasn't in the reckoning for the Grand National at all. They come to the 23rd race, fence in the race, and literally a third of the field collapses. And all out of a sudden, without even losing breath, as we've heard, Micheál O'Hare kicks into gear with Foinaven. He's told the story. He had told the story time and time again that basically he had this forensic task of remembering the colours of the horses, and would start out like weeks, months in advance, and was in the weigh room watching the jockeys come out before the race. And all of a sudden, this black and red combination appeared in front of him that completely stumped him.
That didn't figure in his homework.
Sidles up to the jockey to be told, oh no, this is Foinaven and ran in green previously. The owners didn't fancy the green colours, so we've switched it up today. And like I think that there's, you know, he famously spoke about it on the Late Late Show with Gay Byrne back in the 60s and basically said, well, like, it was prep and this is what you do. But you don't do
it. Making it look easy.
Exactly.
Right?
You don't do it without having the prep. So yeah, the great Micheál O'Hare and probably one of the iconic Grand National moments.
And of course, you cannot do this item without mentioning the magnificent Micheál O'Mara Hurtig.
Gone into the back of the net by Henry Shefflin was there. The high ball in, Dara Ryan was there, and Henry ghosted in from behind him. 218 to Kilkenny and 211. Well, there's a streaker on the ground now. He must be a Kilkenny man because he's quite happy with the situation right now. He's on the 60-yard line. The play's on the other side of the field. The ball now on the 50-yard line. Sent back inside. Picked up again by James Ryle. James Ryle gets it out to the corner. Sent down the field. If the streaker doesn't mind, he'll be going over his direction now. He sees that. He sees the danger. He's moving out the field now towards open territory in the far side. The field and the ball goes out over the line. Hogan stands side of the field. The stewards are moving in on him now from all sides. The hurlers are ignoring it. He's now gone past the centre of the field. Lillis and Cardas are horny chair. Better people are she clown well over. He's dodging his way, trying to get away now from the Moyers. He has made a good run. He's on the 50-yard line, the other side of the field. He's brought to the ground. Play is being halted here. This is not the referee's business. He's quite happy to wait until the pitch is clear. On streaker and gemach then board.
Oh, I don't want it to end. I don't want it to end.
Which is, when this is the clip I always play to media students anytime I'm invited to chat somewhere, is there are people who aren't into sport, but you have to appreciate, always expect the unexpected. And that is the beauty of this form of broadcasting, is that it is so instinctive and you quite literally never know what is going to happen after the game starts.
Our Damien with Claire. But later today, Ireland versus England, St. Patrick's weekend, the Six Nations. We would be hoping for some certainty, a little bit of crushing it perhaps. Although we wish England well, we're all friends now. With Ray, rugby player and yes, Dancing with the Stars, Shane Byrne. And he likes his players mean. Well, this player anyway.
Then Johnny Sexton, his last Six Nations game in front of a home crowd. That's going to be huge for him, isn't it?
Absolutely massive. And that is the key to it, is that we've got to remember, Johnny, look, there's more rugby in it. He said he's going to play on into the World Cup. But we all know, more than likely, in all likelihood, it's finishing after that. He did allude to that's where he's going to finish. So this is his last game in the Aviva, last game playing England, you know, last chance to get the hand on the silverware in the Six Nations. You know, it is an absolutely huge game. And, like, it's not like he's hanging on in by his coattails. He still is the number one 10 in the country. And that's a huge compliment to man at the age he
37.
Is. 37. And 37. And just still as hungry and as grumpy on the pitch as just the way we like him. That's the way we want him.
Yeah, don't do any of that smiling, Johnny.
Not at all.
If in doubt, snarl. Back in a bit. Welcome back. On Arena, a Cayley band.
Three tunes there: Club Killian, Ward's Jig, and The Traveller, played for us by the four members of the Tullic, the Kilfenora Killy Band. Oh, what an awful mistake to make! Who the Tullic Killy Band couldn't be with us. We were delighted the Kilfenora Killy Band came to be here and said, "Jeepers, the one word you shouldn't say when you're talking about the Kilfenora Killy Band." However, will you stay? Will you stay now? Even though I've said that, you're going to come back. You're going to come back and play some tunes for me later when I will have a big K stamped on my forehead to be sure that I don't do that again.
Oh, poor Sean. They did stick around. And on Wednesday, with Ryan, this.
Good morning, The Edge. Good morning. Nice to talk to you again.
And they got right into U2's just released album, Songs of Surrender.
Everyone keeps saying to me, this really matters to The Edge. And I'm hearing that a lot. This is clearly really close to your heart and, dare I say it, your soul. Why is this so personal to you?
Yeah, there's something about songs to me that are like gifts, you know, they arrive, they're kind of mysterious and magical, and they have this power, you know. If they are a strong piece of work, they have a power to become part of the fabric of people's lives. In this case, I think we both, Bono and I, had a long-standing kind of belief that some of our early recordings, we were just way wound up. We were intense young men trying to prove ourselves, trying to get our music across. And the recordings reflected that. So listening back, we always felt, wow, you know, we could probably do these in a different way that would make the songs shine just as pure songs, not necessarily as new recordings that would eclipse the previous recordings, because they're classic. We're not taking those away. We're not deleting previous U2 albums, but just to give a different slant, a different dimension to those songs. And, you know, we've seen it work on a couple of classics when we would play them live. I'm thinking of songs like Every Breaking Wave or Staring at the Sun that ended up becoming iconic in their stripped down version. So the theory was, well, could we do that to a song like Bad? Could we do that to a song like Pride? And it was a bit of an experiment, to be honest. During lockdown, I felt I had the time to try and see where it might lead us. And that was the great discovery, was when Bono started singing over some of these demo arrangements, to discover that, yes, in fact, a great song is kind of indestructible, and you can play it in different ways and arrange it in different styles. It's still the same song in essence, but you might understand it in a different way. You might have a deeper sense of really what it's communicating. And that's what I've discovered making these new arrangements and this Songs of Surrender collection, is these songs have different dimensions. And by presenting this way, I think people will fall in love with them all over again, which is kind of what happened to us.
And while all that might sound quite sunny, Ryan heard something rather more melancholic.
You're giving a very a much more cheerful interpretation of this retrospective, if you like, than I, because at one stage I was listening to it and I wrote down mortality, existential, and I was asking myself, okay, when I knew I was going to be talking to you, you know, is there a sense, is there a wistful, you know, of being of a certain vintage now, looking back about it all, or is it as I've just said, much more joyful than that?
Well, it's both, I think, and that's the beauty of music, is you can hold contrasting ideas in your hand at the same time. So with Stories for Boys, it's like there's an awe about, you know, the power of youth and, you know, what there was there in potential, but also a pathos about, you know, looking back at that time. And I think that's what's emotionally interesting, is the complexity here is not a singular thing like City of Blinding Lights, you know, which is usually a full bore celebratory rock song. In this context, it's got a lot of self-doubt and a much more kind of vulnerable emotion to it, and I think that makes it really interesting.
And after so many years together, Ryan wondered this:
are you the most democratic boy band that ever existed?
Well, you know, there's within U2, it's not equal, but I think what we have is equal respect, in the sense that we all do what we can. Mm. And, you know, that varies hugely between the four members. But we're all important and we're all given, you know, that credit of being a member. And that means we're all on the same level. Doesn't translate necessarily into actions. You know, like if somebody's spending huge amounts of time on something, the others have to acknowledge that and go, look, you know, we're just not as up to speed on what you're doing. So you tell us what you think ought to happen here. We don't vote on stuff, you know, so we're not democratic in that sense. What we do is we get behind what seems to be the prevailing sentiment, you know. Mm-hmm. So this seems to be what everyone wants to do. Let's get behind that. Look, it's worked over many years, so
it ain't broken. It ain't broken.
Yeah.
And then a listener with this anonymous text.
Would you mind asking The Edge why he's called The Edge? I'm sorry, I'm probably the only person in the whole of Ireland that doesn't know the answer to this.
No, not alone there, gentle listener.
There was this tradition of giving nicknames to people, not just our friends and people around us, but people that we came across. So, you know, people would be called Burgundy or The Goose or Little Bitty One Way Street. There was a Gook Pants Delaney. So in that tradition of giving up nicknames, Bono was given the nickname. His first nickname actually was Heinrich van Steichen, bang, bang, bang. But that was a bit of a mouthful. So we changed that to Bonavox of O'Connell Street. And my nickname was The Edge. I think Larry's was The Jam Jar and Adam was Mrs. Burns. So these were our nicknames.
There was no rhyme or reason to you being The Edge, was there? I mean, I think Bono said like you looked like The Edge. I don't know what that means.
I think what it was is in many cases, these nicknames were kind of onomatopoeic. They were to describe the look. So in my case, I think it was the chin inspired The Edge. In fact, before The Edge, I think I was known as In Shakur. Again, probably the same for the chin.
Be looking at him in a whole new light now. The Edge with Ryan Tuberty. And all of that before this properly shocking announcement on Thursday.
I think people are very surprised. We were all surprised here
were
as well.
You?
I mean, the news came in and we're like, what? Wow.
Why were you surprised?
Well, look, I just don't think anyone saw it coming that you've decided to leave The Late Late.
Isn't that nice? I think that's lovely. I let me explain to you, if you don't mind. Thanks for having me on. But I'll explain to you really when I was talking to my daughters about this. I said, you know, when you're at a party and you're really enjoying it and you look around and everyone's having a good time and the music's really good. And it's what I've done is I'm at that party still, but I'm reaching into my pocket for my phone and I'm ordering a taxi.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Anyway, does make sense.
And I'm going to go and then the next day, you know, I just don't want to be sticking around when someone's turning off the music and the lights saying, oh, you're still here.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it makes sense to go now, yeah.
Not an easy decision though, I'm sure, for you.
Not at
did
all.
You have lots of agonising and late nights?
Yes.
And yeah.
I did. I had lots of long walks and talks with myself and I thought it all through. It's just been this extraordinarily big part of my life and my family's life. And I think another 5-10 years of that would be punishment for them. And I'm ready. I'm ready. I'm so comfortable with the decision. You're right, it wasn't easy, but it feels really good. I've had a joyful time.
Well, now, but steady the ship, for the radio is going nowhere. Clearly priority number one. But what else might be up his sleeve?
I'm only 50.
Yes.
And the young people
are
listening
going,
he's ancient. So what I would love to do is, I've got so many ideas about, I love, you know, books, history, politics, Ireland, museums, and combining and travel and combining all of these things for programs, documentaries. I'd like to write again. Mm-hmm. I'd like to go back to academia for a little while as well, part time. So I'm so passionate. The whole point of this job that you do so well and that I've endeavored to do is curiosity and passion. And when you have those two things, mm-hmm. you'll never be bored.
Point well made. But what about the Late Late Toy Show? Surely you'd come out again for that.
A listener wants to know, would you just keep doing the toy show? Could you do that? Have you been asked by RTE to consider that?
No, it's a fair question. And the answer is no.
Absolutely no.
But no, not going to happen.
But if enough people said, Ryan, this was your thing, you were brilliant
at it. That's like, now hang on, you've got to understand, I'm now in the taxi leaving the party and you're chasing down the street saying, come back, have one more. And I'm saying, I've had my fun and it was glorious. It was glorious. Like that toy show is magic. There's magic in the air. You want to see behind the scenes of that show. It's beautiful. That'll be hard to say goodbye to, but there will be no return. I know when it's time to say goodbye and... like the song says, it is indeed time to say goodbye.
Fair play. Friday nights from here on in, pure fun. But it is a cruel business because a mere 2 hours later, this from Director General Dee Forbes.
We'll now sit down and we'll have a look at what's next, who's next in that seat. And of course, we'll make that announcement in due course.
Who might be in the frame?
Well, Brian, maybe you tell me. Do you fancy it?
No, I'm ruling. What did you ask? I'm ruling myself out.
I'd say there'll be a trail of fruit baskets to that office. I believe she's partial to a scented candle. We're available to serve. Well, that is it for this week's playback. Thank you for listening. But sticking with Ryan and the party analogy, Louise Duffy kicked off with this on Thursday, and it feels apt. Talk to you next week.
That she's alone.